It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This election season, voters are searching for information, accurate information, and not just about the candidates, but also about the entire voting process, whether it's the proper procedure for voting by mail or safeguards at polling places. The situation can be described as confusing. Some voters have reported issues with the state's website. Post Industrial Media is one of a coalition of newsrooms across the nation investigating tips as part of ProPublica's Election Land Project. Post Industrial CEO and Editor-in-Chief Kim Palmero joins us now. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you so much for having us on the program.
Before we get to the stories that Post Industrial is reporting, what's the purpose of the nationwide project?
The purpose is to really help voters kind of cut through what ProPublica wisely saw, as in many outlets saw, as a confusion given this largely mail-in election. As we know, election functions are largely very local, manned by a lot of very devoted public servants. And this is a challenge, and they have a lot of paper to move around, new processes. And we regard one of the functions of journalism is helping and providing truth and facts. And so in whatever way we can investigate any kind of confusion or concerns, we wanted to participate in that.
The genesis for some of the reports are tips. Let's face it, all newsrooms get tips throughout the year. But have you been getting more tips than usual?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you asked that, because in my more than 20 years in both planning election coverage and being in newsrooms on election nights from state to local to national, I have never, ever seen the amount of questions, confusion as now. And I will state off the top that this is not always really the fault of the local elections divisions. We are, just to give you an idea, Election Land, we promote their line for people to call, reach out to them, and then they route tips to the local newsroom. So we are one of the local newsrooms here. They will route that information to us, and now we're going to also route to ESA. Yesterday, we got routed to us approximately one dozen questions or concerns. I wouldn't say any one of them was a real serious matter, but it was confusion or not being able to get through. Now, it's just a ton. Normally, leading up to election, we wouldn't see any kind of numbers like this.
What did you find out with our county elections offices in the region? Are they equipped? Are they overwhelmed in trying to handle the flood of requests for mail-in ballots and even questions about the voting process?
We have some indications that some of the outlying counties, we fielded a couple tips about Fayette in particular. They are struggling with the volume, but they are getting more people to try to handle it. You know, things like answering phone calls or just coming to the front desk. Using Fayette as an example, they may be trying to keep up with the volume. I think the rural counties is where, you know, maybe we'll see some challenges in terms of volume, but they certainly have reassured us and our reporter talking to various people that they are catching up and everyone will be able to get what they need in a timely manner. I think one thing that has stood out to us in talking to people is that the elections officials, the local elections officials, are all extraordinarily committed and, I think confident in their process and really want to make sure that voters know that they are doing their best and they will get back to them.
So elections offices, they're adding staff, they're beefing up. Are they concerned that there's no repeat of what happened in Luzerne County, where a newly hired employee threw out 9 ballots accidentally because they didn't receive enough training in the first place?
Let's put it this way. We're asking a lot of questions and we hope will come out before they create real problems. But because this is so much of this is unlike the way an election has been conducted previously on this scale, there is a chance, I think, that someone is going to make a mistake, certainly. We can only hope that you know, the training is there at the state level.
President Trump has repeatedly called into question, without evidence, the legitimacy of mail-in ballots and the integrity of the election. What, if anything, are the county elections offices doing to counter any misinformation that's out there?
That is a hard question, because I think I see them hammering home, this is the process, this is the process. They are trying to make it as clear as they can. And I think that those who are voting really just have to take extra care to take their civic duty very, very seriously. Frankly, I see voting this year as more of an investment of time than it has been, but that's part of our civic responsibility.
Kim Palmero is the CEO and editor-in-chief of Post Industrial Media, one of many newsrooms participating in the ProPublica election land project, including WESA. Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Preliminary numbers from the State Department of Health indicate more than 4,300 Pennsylvanians died from drug overdoses last year. According to the CDC, about one of every three fatal overdoses nationwide involves prescription opioids. Many of those prescribed painkillers come from physicians, but some might have been prescribed by dentists. So what can dentists do to help quell the opioid crisis? Dr. Deborah Polk is an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh School of Dental Medicine and a psychologist who studies health behaviors. Dr. Polk, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
According to the Journal of the American Dental Association, dentists prescribe 12% of immediate-release opioids like hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine in the U.S., behind only family physicians who prescribe 15% of those immediate-release opioids. What other pain management techniques are available for dentists or patients who want to avoid those painkillers?
Sure. Well, actually, evidence suggests that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, either alone or in combination with acetaminophen, are probably as effective or even superior to opioids in managing acute dental pain.
You recently received a grant from the FDA to try to curb opioid prescribing in dental settings and develop new ways to manage acute dental pain. So what's the plan to come up with these new procedures?
Well, actually, what we're doing is drawing on existing evidence. So I would say in the past 20 years or so, a lot of research has been conducted to demonstrate that there are very effective alternatives to opioids. What we're doing is pulling that evidence together in an organized way so that we can present it in what's called an evidence-based guideline that we can give to providers to help them make the best decisions possible.
This evidence, do you see it put together in a plan for dentists to use? Would it be flexible enough so that they could adjust it patient by patient?
Oh, absolutely. Adjust it patient by patient. There are a lot of nuances that need to be taken into consideration. For example, if a patient has compromised liver function or kidney function, then the provider, and I want to clarify, it's not just dentists, but also emergency physicians are faced with helping people with dental pain. So our guideline is broader than just for dentists. But you definitely need to tailor it for the patient and understand their health history to be able to make the best decision for that patient.
So how does this research fit into the existing scholarship, the traditional practices of what's going on now or has been going on?
So taking the next step and not just putting this out in a one study at a time kind of fashion, but we're really gathering all of the information together in a very organized and systematic way. And we will be bringing together a number of stakeholders and experts to review the information and make guideline recommendations.
So how might this partnership help dentists understand and respond to the opioid epidemic itself?
So in addition to creating the clinical practice guideline, we're also going to have a whole set of strategies for sharing this information nationwide, actually. So we will be creating continuing education courses and chairside guides. We'll be publishing articles in journals to really try to get the information out there, number one. And then also provide guidance to dentists specifically about how to change their practice patterns.
No doctor wants to see their patient in pain. So how do you break that cycle of prescription because it might be an easier way to ease the pain?
Well, I'm not sure it's an easier way to ease the pain, but I think you're absolutely right in describing it as a cycle that needs to be broken. I think that just like all of us, providers develop habits. And there's a whole technology and science behind how to break habits. And so we'll be using some of those strategies to help our providers adopt new habits.
These new habits, you hope, will help dentists reduce opioid abuse?
Exactly. Exactly. Right.
Dr. Deborah Polk is an assistant professor of dental public health at the University of Pittsburgh School of Dental Medicine. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for your interest.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As a teenager in Pittsburgh, Ernie Hawkins discovered the music of the Reverend Gary Davis, an iconic figure in the history of the blues. Upon graduating high school in 1965, Hawkins went to New York City and began studying with Davis. As their friendship grew, Davis accompanied Hawkins back to Pittsburgh several times, and on one of those trips, Hawkins borrowed a tape recorder. Those recordings provide an intimate portrait of a true American original and are now available in a 3-CD set titled See What the Lord Has Done for Me. 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker recently visited with Ernie Hawkins.
Ernie Hawkins, thanks for sitting with me and talking about the Reverend Gary Davis and this unusual collection of CDs that you've just released.
Well, always a pleasure to talk about the Reverend, that's for sure.
Is he a foundational element of a particular type of American folk music?
I would say yes. I mean, there are a lot of finger pickers. Blues players were great finger pickers. Gary Davis was in a category by himself. He was blind from babyhood. And he was so gifted, and he was basically kind of a walking encyclopedia. He could play anything. You know, he was born in 1896, and by the 20s, he was just, you know, ripping stuff and recording in the 30s. And he was just so brilliant that people, like, I read his welfare records, you know, being blind, and his welfare workers would write notes like, I have never, ever in my life seen anything so brilliant as his guitar playing. And when you could see him do it, and he was an incredibly generous, loving, patient teacher, you could figure it out.
Did he feel that he was passing on something that needed to be passed on? Did he feel as if he were a keeper of a flame and was happy to pass it on?
Absolutely.
When you talk about the Rev's playing and his singing, it's a touchstone to another era, isn't it? You're
yeah.
actually reaching the 19th century in the very early
yeah.
20th century by listening to what he did and how he
yeah.
did it.
Yeah, and his songs sort of summarized a lot of that. They pulled everything out of that tradition and put it together with this brilliant, almost Baroque kind of guitar playing, lots of competing melodies, counterpoint, and very complex lines working against each other brilliantly, and he brought that whole tradition into everything he was playing.
Let me ask you to talk about the time that he spent in Pittsburgh.
We brought him into the Carnegie Music Hall for concerts, and then we brought him in a couple times for the two Pittsburgh Blues Festivals. I believe they were 69 and 70, or 70 and 71. and he kind of headlined those.
What kind of reaction did the people in Pittsburgh have when they got to be up close and personal with an icon like this?
Just total warmth and friendship. And, you know, he was staying in an apartment with us, and people just be there all the time, listening, talking, eating, telling stories. He loved people. He loved being around people. He could entertain and tell stories and tell jokes and just play all day long. He just loved it, loved people. My mom would come by all the time. They got to know each other really well. And he got to know a lot of people in Pittsburgh, and he was beloved.
What was it that made you go and get the recorders and set them up and capture what you
captured?
Well,
he was there, and I just thought, just let him play, talk about the old songs, you know, ask him, follow through with other songs, and just get his imagination and memory rolling, and stand back and just let it happen. He was so happy to do it, and he said, you know, this is yours. You will always have these. And he knew who he was. And
he knew what he had.
He knew what he had, for sure.
Can you tell me a little bit about taking the raw tapes and getting them called down to where they fit onto three CDs?
Well, what I did was I called my friend Stefan Grossman, who puts out a lot of CDs. And if there's an old recording of any bluesman, electric or acoustic, it's going to be on Stefan Grossman's Guitar Workshop site.
Have you had any reaction from people that are encouraging?
Oh, we've had, I've gotten at least one review Stefan sent me, and it's beautiful. People recognize that these are important, unusual tapes because it's just Gary Davis just sitting around, not in a studio, you know, just sitting around really being relaxed, and sometimes he'll play a song for 20 minutes. Like a song like Crucifixion, where he sort of has this beautiful guitar part, and over it he tells the whole story of the crucifixion. Sometimes the song is 10 minutes long, sometimes 15, sometimes 20 minutes. And so I have some beautiful long versions of songs where he just kind of stretched out and improvised and kind of amazing.
Won't you tell me, Lord, who?
This is source material from a man who was source material for an entire genre of American music.
Yeah. Blues is the music of America, if you ask me. Blues and jazz. Something about my generation in the 60s, people heard this music, we heard this music, and it really spoke to deep places. It really spoke to deep places.
It still does.
It still does and always will.
Ernie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Blues recording artist Ernie Hawkins talking with WESA's Bob Studebaker. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.